Well, welcome, welcome, welcome to my chance to tell you about one of the most exciting stories in the Bible. So Esther is really a big book for me. It's the first book I ever read in all the way through in Hebrew. And it was really marvelous for me to get to do it, but it was fun. And I can't wait to remind you if you already know the story or tell you if you don't, because this story's got everything you need. It's got palace intrigue that makes what's going on in England look like nothing. I mean, you'll say, Prince Harry who? That's nothing. It's not just got palace intrigue. It's got these great plot twists that are worthy of Stephen King. It's got, even beyond that, these great moral ideas of the proud falling flat on their face. It's got the first female superhero, I think, maybe in history. And it's all wrapped up around one of my favorite subjects, food. Because the story of Esther is a story that's told around 10 different banquets. So here's what we need to do. We're going to do three things in the time I've got with you. And Jarrett, bless his heart, Pastor Jarrett did something very dangerous. First of all, are we not so thankful to have Pastor Jarrett? When I found out he was going to be preaching at the North Campus and he asked me if I'd fill in here for this campus, I said, well, if you're at the North Campus, I think I want to go up there and hear you. He says, you can catch me on video later. I said, okay, then I'll do it. But I thank him for the honor of getting to be here this morning. But he sent me this really dangerous message. He said, it's okay if you run over. We'll make it up at the back end. Well, there is no back end. When I'm done, we're done. We'll have an invitation song, but we're not going to cut that short. And then we're out. I mean, announcements have been made. So set your watches. I will be done within 2 hours, guaranteed. But what I want to do in the process are three things with you. First, we need to set the stage a little bit. We need to understand the context of the book. And then the second thing we're going to do is tell the story. Let's see how the story unfolds. And then the third thing we're going to do is ask that very important question, so what does that mean for me? How does that change my world? Why am I different when I leave here than I was when I came? So if that's our agenda, let's start with setting the stage. Now, those of you who are in my class or have been to my class know I love PowerPoint. And so I have a tendency to use PowerPoint and to put things up there. And bless his heart, Chris Munoz sent me an email and he said, I think we've got about one-third of your screen available for you back there. So I've ooched everything up at the top, and you're just going to have to endure it. But we'll start by setting the stage. So you've got a very limited map, but it'll give you some idea of where we are. Now, to orient you on this map, the Star of David I've put over where Israel is. We're concerned about these areas that today are Iran and Iraq. But at the time we're talking about, which is the story starts in 483 BC about, and it goes on for a number of years that are all wrapped up in those 10 chapters. 483 BC, to help orient you, that's the year that the Buddha died in China. Confucius is still around in China. Socrates is not born yet, but he's right around the corner. He'll be born in the Greek world. And the Jews are living in captivity. And so that's the story. And because we're back in 483, instead of Iraq and Iran, we're going to call that area ancient Persia. The story takes place in the town, or the city of Susa. That's where the king of Persia kept his winter palace. During the summers, the kings would go off and fight. During the winters, they would do whatever they do. You know, go home, be kings. So our king is a fellow that we've got some engravings of This is a picture of him, an engraving, and he was proud enough not to have it wiped off the stone, so it must be a decent representation of him. Now, if we were going to look at his name in Persian, a lot of you probably don't read cuneiform, and so I put some English letters under it, but even with those, I challenge you, I dare you to pronounce that. It ain't that easy. And so you've got this Persian word, and the Jews, the Hebrews, they're having trouble with it. They don't read cuneiform either, by and large, not their native, at least, reading. So we'll read in the Hebrew, Ahasuerus. The ah sound means we're borrowing a foreign word. So Ahasuerus is the way they were pronouncing the Shashayashashush. And then we get it into English, and the English translators say Ahasuerus, which isn't even close to the Hebrew, Ahasuerus, which isn't all that close to the Zesayasha, and Zesayasha, the Greeks had trouble with. So the Greeks can't say it either, so they just put it into Greek with the first couple of sounds, Zerxash, or we say Xerxes when we read the Greek. All the same dude, okay? So you got him. That's him. Guy on the left, that's the guy we're concerned about. Now, we know about Xerxes apart from the Bible. There's a Greek historian who was born in the same century, so he's fairly contemporaneous, who wrote a book called The Histories. The Greek historian was Herodotus. And Herodotus writes the histories, and he writes about Xerxes because Xerxes was constantly taking his armies and trying to conquer Greece. Herodotus is a Greek, didn't like Xerxes, doesn't have nice things to say about him. But as we read through what he says, we learn a couple of things, and you need to know this before we talk about the story. You need to know that Xerxes was overly confident in his abilities. He thought he was something greater than he really was. Turned out he wasn't all that hot, at least on the battlefield. He rapidly changed his mind. And you read the histories from Herodotus, and he'll have one counselor say, go to battle over here. And he'll say, that's what we're going to do. And then another counselor will say, I wouldn't do that. And he'll say, yeah, neither would I. Then the first counselor would come back and say, yeah, I think you should do it. He says, yeah, I think you're right. Then the next one would come back and say, no, you really don't want to. And he says, yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, you're right. I mean, it was this wishy-washy flip-flopping in modern language. But he really leaned hard on his advisors. In fact, at one point, he even had one of his advisors dress in the king's clothes and sleep on his altar, on the king's throne, I should say. So that overnight he'd have visions and he'd be accountable to the gods for the actions as if he was the king. Because the king's just trying to figure out what to do and he doesn't have a clue. So that's what we've got here. Now, he's also really interested in court luxuries. He doesn't mind going off to battle, but he's a show-off. And he loves the high life. He loves to live in extravagance. He's rich and he wants everybody to know it. And he wants all of the luxuries that money and position can buy. And that's who he is. Now, we know that about him. That's important for you to know. One last thing I need to tell you to set the stage, because if you don't get this, you're missing part of the story, okay? There's a Greek, or a word from a Greek letter. The letter's chi. The word is a chiasm. Chi is a Greek letter that's shaped like an X. And chiasm was a manner of writing back in the Hebrew times that's important for us to know. Lots of the Bible's written in chiasm. Chiasm is where you have a storyline and then another event and then another event and then another event and then another event, however many you may have. It doesn't have to be five. Happens to be five in Esther. Maybe more, depends on how you break it apart. But then those events are done in reverse order, sort of. So if you're going to have a party for three, then later on you have a party for three. And then you're going to have a meeting of advisors, and then you're going to have a meeting of advisors. And it folds back over itself. It follows the shape of the Greek X, the chi. It's called chiasm. You got it? Can't understand the Tower of Babel without understanding this. That story's written this way. Lots of stories, because here's what it means. Here's why it's important. In Hebrew writing with a chiasm, the middle point is the emphasis. In most lectures you and I might give, we put the emphasis right at the front or right at the end. They buried their lead. They put it right in the middle. But when you're learning the story, you want to know the middle because you learn that's the emphasis that they really want to pound their foot on. And lots of it's important. I'm not saying it's not, but that's the one they really want you to say, oh, look what they put at that point. Okay? So that's setting the stage. With that, let's tell the story. It's a great story. I'm going to tell it to you around the banquets. So the story starts out in the third year of King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus, whatever you want to call him, starts out in the third year of his reign. His reign's a troubled reign. He's always having fights with the Greeks, and he wants to show that he's the biggest and the best, and he wants everybody to be afraid of him. Darrell, I wish I had your voice. Can I just say thank you for blessing us this morning with that song? But y'all join me in just thanking God for the voice he gave Darrell. And Pastor Brent and all of our worship team, what they do, when Pastor Brent asked me if I'd speak about name, I was so honored and touched, and I thank you for that opportunity because it's, you know, his heart, as you've seen, his heart is to not only lead us in worship, but to mentor the next generation of leaders. And so he's got people up here that are young enough to be my kids. And all I can say is thank you for doing that. Thank you for putting up people that not only lead us in worship, And you keep people that are old like me so I don't feel out of place, but you've got the next generation up there and you're teaching them how to lead and how to be accountable to God's people. And there are not a lot of people out there doing that. He works really hard at that. Would you join me in thanking him also? And everybody that works on that team and all of the backstage people. It's amazing. They get here early Sunday to prep and to practice, and it's just amazing. But all of that's behind the scenes. You don't see that. Ahasuerus, he's doing it all publicly. He wants to show off. He wants everybody to see it. He wants everybody to know it. And so he's got a big banquet. I'm talking big banquet. I'm talking 180 days. That's 6 months. That's basically the whole time he's not in campaign of war. And he's bringing in all of these people, and he's showing off everything because he wants everybody to think he's important. When I took my first job in the law field, I was at a place, a big law firm. I mean, like 888 lawyers. I was like lawyer number 857. And I got told by the people who'd been there before me, appearance is 90% of the game. 10% is legal work, but 90% of how you, he said, most lawyers here will never work with you. So it's just a question, if they're going to vote for you for partner, it's just a question of their perception. So you've got to act like you're really good. And you've got to stay here, get here early and stay late. Don't ever leave before the big partners leave. And I thought, well, makes sense to me. You know, I'd like to do good work in addition to that. You know, if you're going to be there, might as well show. But one Friday, Bob Mace comes to me and he says, Lanier, I got to leave early. I got dinner party. And I said, okay. He said, I can't leave. Jim Sales hadn't left yet. I said, okay. What's that have to do with me? He says, well, I want you to go with me. And I said, Bob, I can't do that. He says, look, man, it's six o'clock on a Friday evening. We ought to be able to leave by now. I'm not waiting for Sales to leave. I said, well, how are we going to do this? He says, we're going to go down a flight of stairs and we're going to get on the elevator at the flight below. And he won't see us go to the elevator bank that way. We'll just go down a flight of stairs, get on the elevator. So I said, okay. So we go downstairs, we get on the elevator, and the elevator doors open. And as they open for us to get there, Jim Sales is on the elevator. And I'm like, well, we just got busted. Bob Mace didn't miss a beat. Now it's 6 p.m. He looks at me and says, "So Lanier, where do you want to eat lunch?" Like, we're just now going to lunch. It was all perception for the king, or not all, but a good bit of perception. So after he has this big show-off banquet, then he has another banquet for 7 days. It's his public banquet. And this is where he's showing off more. Now, you will be shocked to find this out, but there's more than a little tipping going on. They're drinking like fish, okay? And so they on the seventh day, the king is drunk as a skunk, is what the Hebrew says. It's translated a little bit differently. He is happy with merriment in his heart after much drink, I think is what it might say. So he says, "Hey, somebody, go get my queen. Go get Queen Vashti. She's good looking. I want everybody to see the kind of woman I've got as queen." Well, now, Queen Vashti, she doesn't have much to do with her husband, and she's throwing her own party. She's got her own banquet going on. So while he's got this public banquet, she's got a competing banquet, and the king's missives show up and say, "Hey, the king would like you to come show off for everybody." And she says, "I ain't going in front of that drunk goon. I got my own party going on here. Go tell him, heh-eh." And so they go back and said, "She's not coming." He says, "What?" She said, "Heh-eh." And he said, that's Persian. He said, "This is infuriating." And he flies off the handle. So he calls a big counseling session in, and he gets his advisors. And he says, "Okay, tell me what to do. You know, what does the law say I should do?" And his advisors say, "Well, first of all, you've really, really got a problem on your hands. Because here's what's going to happen. Word's going to get out. Everybody's going to know the king called Vashti in. And Vashti, the queen, says, ha-ah. And that means in every household all around your empire, when a husband tells his wife to do something, she's going to feel fully enabled to go, ha-ah. So you have basically destroyed the moral fabric of our society if you let this go on." King says, "Okay, so what do I need to do?" "You declare that Vashti will never come into your presence again. That she has walked across the line that cannot be returned. She's history. Wash your hands of her." King says, "Yeah, I mean, whoever had the last word with him," he was like, "Yeah, that sounds good to me." So he's like, "Okay, that's what we're going to do." And then they said, "This is fantastic. Now, whenever a husband tells his wife, hey, come on, do this. She's going to say, oh, I better do it. Or you know what happened to Queen Vashti? So you have just taken care of things." So it's like they're having the big guy fraternity party over this. They're all real happy. And, you know, probably have horrible marriages too. But anyway, the result of all of this is she's stripped, and now the king doesn't have a queen, so he declares a beauty pageant to find him a new one. There you go. Now, meanwhile, we've got a little story interruption here to talk about a fellow named Mordecai, the Benjaminite Jew. Now, that's important. If we had a lot of time, I'd tell you some more details as to why. But he's related to King Saul. Saul was a Benjaminite. That becomes kind of important in a little subcontext way. So, you've got this Jew named Mordecai, which sounds very Jewish, but it's not a Jewish name at all. It's actually a Persian name. Mordecai, the Jew, and he is a pretty decently well-heeled in the king's society fella. He hangs around the city gates and outside the king. Now, he's rearing his niece slash cousin, the daughter of his uncle, who's now dead. The uncle and aunt died. Her name is Hadassah in Hebrew, which means myrtle, like crepe myrtle. But she's also known as Esther in her Persian name. And Esther is beautiful. The Hebrew not only says that she was good to the eyes, which is what it said about Vashti, she's good to the eyes, but it also says of her, she was beautiful in form. So the writer wants you to know, on a scale of 1 to 10, she's a 12. She's a knockout. But you will learn, more important than her outward beauty is her inner beauty and character as the story unfolds. And so he's raised her. He's like a father to her. She gets enrolled in the beauty pageant. Now, the beauty pageant's not the way it's done today. You've got a year's prep time under the care of the king's concubine keepers. And they get you all ready. They teach you the ways of the royal court. You've got to learn all this stuff. They put you on a serious diet. They give you weightlifting. They do, I made that up. But they do the dieting part. They give you makeup galore. They really want you to do the best, and then you get to go in with the king. And if the king likes you, you may win. If you're not so memorable, you'll probably never see him again. But you get put up in his concubine, his harem forever, and so you'll be okay. So Esther is enrolled in the pageant, and because of her inner character, the people who are running the king's camp for young virginal women, those people really take a shine to her. And they give her the best food, and they give her the best help maids to attend her. And they really take good care of her. So she goes and she goes in front of the king and goes to spend the night with the king. And she's taken great pains to do everything she's been taught to do. And lo and behold, the king's blown away. And Esther wins the beauty pageant. And do you know what they do? They have a banquet. Of course they do. So this is banquet number 4. This is the Esther banquet. In fact, they call it the Esther banquet in the book. This is the Esther feast. Big party time. And everything's great. Now, meanwhile, Mordecai is still hanging around the gate. And he hears two of the king's guard type people plotting how to kill the king. So this is some palace intrigue, and this is pretty good. So Mordecai gets word to Esther, who's now in the palace as the queen, and says, here's the bottom line. You got to go to the king, and wouldn't hurt to drop my name and say, Mordecai said this, so that, you know, like the king, you know, we're like this now. You know, I'm the lifesaver. So she goes and she says to the king, oh, by the way, hubby king, whatever she called him, Mordecai, your servant, has overheard these two guys plotting to kill you. King says, investigate that. They investigate it, finds out it's true. They kill him, hang him, both of them, gone. Gets entered into the records. Mordecai, good guy, saved the king's neck, killed both of the plotters. So that's what happens. Now, in the process of this, we're also meeting another fella. This fella's name is Haman, and he's an Agagite. Now, I don't know if you've ever met an Agagite or not, but they're troublesome, and they've always been troublesome, and any good Hebrew reading their Bible will know the Agagites have had it in and have messed up important lives of important Hebrews for a long time. King Saul got his king stripped from him from God because God told him to kill the Agagite and he didn't. An Agagite cost Mordecai's great, 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 great grandfather his kingship. So this is like round two of the Benjaminite versus the Agagite. And Mordecai's not going to leave it there. So Haman expects everybody to bow to him. And Mordecai's like, I ain't bowing to him. He's an Agagite. Why would I, a Benjaminite, bow to an Agagite? I'm not going to do it. And it incenses, it infuriates Haman. So Haman decides, I'm going to annihilate all the Jews. And he sets out a plot to destroy all the Jews. And his plot is pretty clear. He goes to the king and he says, hey, there's a bunch of people that are messing with you that aren't following your rules, and they act like they're their own people, and they're just going to tear apart your kingdom. And how are you going to beat the Greeks when you got these people inside your kingdom who are messing you up? And the king says, well, what do you think I ought to do? I mean, this is who he was. Well, what do you think I ought to do? He said, well, I just think you need to sign a decree that on this day, for this much money, everybody can kill a Jew, and or as many as they want, and take their possessions. King says, oh, okay, that sounds like a good deal. Where do I sign? And the king signs the deal. And then they have a banquet to celebrate this sinister plot, because that's what they tend to do. And here we are at banquet number 5. Now, Mordecai hears about this because there are placards going all over here coming up on, you know, in 6 months or whenever it is. Kill a Jew day. You get to take his plunder, everything you can after you kill them. And so Mordecai tries to get Esther involved in Teamwork 2, the sequel. He says, you need to go to the king and you need to tell him about this. And Esther says, I can't do that. You don't understand. I only go in front of the king when he calls me. That's one of the rules. It worked last time because he called me. But if he hadn't called me in a long time. And if he doesn't call me and I go in front of him, I have just usurped his authority because I've summoned him instead of him summoning me. And that's like, you're dead. And Mordecai says, look, sweets, you are a Jew. Do you not realize on Kill a Jew Day, you can die too? Don't think because you're there, you're going to be protected. She says, well, I just don't think it's wise. I can't really just go in front of the king. He says, you got to do it. So then Esther calls an anti-fast, an anti-banquet. And the anti-banquet is, okay, we're not going to eat for 3 days. You have all the Jews, don't eat for 3 days. And then after 3 days, I'll go in front of the king and I'll see if I get killed or not. But if I do, it's on your head. Now, when you're reading this in the Hebrew, you've got to understand it reads very serious, but also very light. The celebration of this is very close to the celebration that exists exists in English for Halloween. Kids dress up like the characters for Purim, which celebrates this whole thing. And you find them, you know, it's a party atmosphere where this story is read. So it's okay to look at it, but this is the anti-fast. It's not eating. And then I left this out. So then she, after 3 days, she kind of loiters outside just in the king's peripheral vision. And he looks at her and goes, oh, that's beautiful Esther. I haven't seen her in a long time. Hey, Esther, come here. What can I do for you? And she says, I just want to host a banquet, and I'd love to have you and, say, Haman come. Haman's like, did I just hear I'm invited? Just me and El Kingo? Feeling pretty good. And the king says, absolutely. When? Tonight. And that's the setup banquet. So they have a banquet that night. And the king knows the banquet's for something. He says, okay, well, now what do you really want? I'll give you anything you want. And she said, okay, would you come to dinner again tomorrow night? That's what I really want. I just want you and Haman to come to dinner one more time. He says, okay. And now, if we were working through the Hebrew chiasm, we just hit the point of emphasis. Because this is the point where everything converges and then unfolds the way it had already folded up. And what happens over the next 24 hours is huge. Haman goes skipping home. He's singing, zippity-doo-dah, zippity-a. My, oh my, what a wonderful day. He gets home, but on his way home, he sees Mordecai. And Mordecai won't bow down. And he's like, oh, I'm so mad. I can't wait for that day to come where everybody gets to kill the Jews. And he goes home, and his wife says, so how was it? And he says, it was amazing, but I'm sorry. I just can't handle it. I saw that Mordecai, and I don't care how great it was. If long as that guy's alive, I'm not happy. She said, look, just don't wait for the day where everybody kills the Jews. Just build a gallows. You're like big Lord guy with the king. Just build a gallows and just hang him. He says, brilliant, wife. Absolutely brilliant. Now I'm happy. And by the way, I have dinner tomorrow night with the king and his queen again, just the three of us. It's an intimate thing. And I'm going to see that this guy's hung beforehand. So that morning, he gets to work early in the palace. And when he goes to work, he on the way, he leaves instructions, build a gallows. We're going to do some hanging today. So he's got the workers building the gallows. He shows up early. Meanwhile, the king's had a really bad night's sleep. And he wakes up and he says to his wise people, man, I can't figure out why I didn't sleep good last night. Something's nagging at me. I've forgotten something. Read the records of maybe I forgot to pay the electric bill or something. Just read through the And so they pull out the records and they read about Mordecai saving his life. He says, what did I do for Mordecai? Nothing. I got to fix that. That's the problem. So what happens? He calls in Haman and he says, Haman, yeah, what should the king do for someone he really treasures, who's really done him a great service? And Haman thinks he's talking about Haman. And Haman says, put a royal robe on him? King says, yeah. Put him on a royal horse? Yeah. Then have a trusted servant or a trusted advisor, somebody high in the kingdom, lead him around and say, look, this is the wonderful glory the king passes upon those with whom he owes honor. King goes, that's exactly what we're going to do. And Haman says, great. King says, look, Mordecai the Jew's outside, and that's the guy I need to honor. So would you get a royal robe on him, and I want you to carry around the reins of the horse and parade him through the street saying, look how the king honors those to be honored. In other words, Mordecai is the reason Haman falls flat on his face. The next night, and I've got to get through this quickly, the next night the trap is set. The king says, what do you want? After a humiliating day of parading Mordecai around, Haman sits there and listens as she says, well, someone's trying to kill me and all of my people. And the king says, who would do such a thing? And she says, him. And Haman's like, what? And the king's so mad, he gets up and he storms out of the room. And when he does, Haman starts begging the queen. And as he begs, he kind of trips and falls on her. And the king walks back in to see him lying on the queen. He's like, oh, now you're going to assault my queen. Okay, you're it. Find a gallows. Hang him. And he gets hung on the gallows he was building for Mordecai. Well, they have a banquet to celebrate the good news that the Jews aren't going to get killed. And then on the day that the Jews don't get killed, they have a victory banquet. And then a couple of days later, they have a cleanup banquet. And that's the story. Now, you can't leave yet. It's a great story, but the question is, so what? Let me give you three so whats, and then we'll be out of here. Well, then we'll have an invitation. The month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that was the month where everybody got to kill the Jews. Instead, the Jews had victory that month. And there's a lesson here. There is a time to weep, and there is a time to laugh. And this story is loaded with sad, disturbing moments, but also absolutely humorous moments. This story is a graphic example of the reality of our world, that we go through stages where It's right to weep, and it's right to offer encouragement and comfort and consolation through Jesus and the love of the Father. But there's also a time to laugh and enjoy life, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's the cycle of life. And if you're in the miserable part, I want to give you the second point for home. This story begins in verse 1. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, and it ends in chapter 10, verse 3, with peace to all his people. And between 1:1 and 10:3, in this entire story, God's not mentioned once. There is no mention of God. And yet God's on every page, in every verse, behind it all. So if you're in a time to weep or you're in a time to laugh, I want to assure you of something. God is in control. Whether we acknowledge him, whether we speak of him, whether we call his name, the loudest thing the writer could ever do to tell you God is in control is tell this entire story, which has God's thumbprint firmly on it, and never mention the name of God. That absence shouts from every page, because God is in control. Last point. When Esther didn't want to do it, didn't want to go in front of the king, didn't want to risk it, Mordecai said, "Who knows? Who knows whether you've not come into the kingdom for such a time as this?" And that wasn't simply for Esther. That is for all of us, because God has a purpose for you today.
Thank you for joining us online. We hope today's experience encouraged and challenged you. At Champion Forest, we are passionate about all kinds of people coming to know God, to grow in their relationship with Him and others, and then to go out and make a difference in the world. We would love the opportunity to talk and pray with you. To connect with us, just go to championforest.org/connect. And hey, of course, we can't wait to welcome you on campus, in person, on one of our locations. We'll see you soon.